You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting, streaming video units. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. On this episode of the show, as we prepare to review Anna Lily Amirpour's The Bad Batch, Allison and I, and all the other non-functioning members of society, are heading out to the desert to start a rave cult. Because, let's be honest, that's starting to sound like as welcoming a plan for the future as anything else anyone's got going on these days.
Yeah, seriously, all glory to the dream. Inspired by The Bad Batch, we were going to dedicate this episode to cinematic explorations of that greatest of taboos and handiest of allegories. Anthropophagy, the eating of the long pig, the consumption of other humans. And then we did. Yes, so brace yourself.
Thundercrack. Dun, dun, dun.
Brace yourself for some cannibalism wrecks that you can rent or stream at home right now. After this, our listener's choice review of The Bad Batch.
The chaos of this world is vast and unknowable. We like to think we can understand it. But we can't.
As you know by now, on every episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Units, we let you tell us what we should discuss as our main review by choosing from one of three options in an online poll. This time around, your choices were Anna Lily Amirpour's dystopian The Bad Batch on Netflix, Bertrand Bonello's terrorist attack drama Nocturama, also on Netflix, and Ben Young's abduction thriller Hounds of Love on Hulu. And actually, The Bad Batch and Nocturama kept neck and neck right up to the end when The Bad Batch pulled ahead for the win. The Bad Batch is the second film from Amirpour, whose debut was 2014's A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. That was, you know, your standard black and white film set in an Iranian ghost town where a lonely, chador-wearing vampire preys upon abusive men, falls in love with a moody but extremely handsome guy. The Bad Batch is similarly indescribable. It is a dystopian movie taking place in this fenced-in stretch of desert. The U.S. seems to have seceded in order to have a place to dump all unwanted citizens, among them criminals and the undocumented. We don't know what Arlen, the main character played by Suki Waterhouse, did to get labeled and tattooed as one of the Bad Batch. But when the film starts, that's where she's getting dumped on the other side of the fence, where she almost immediately has a run-in with some of the nastier denizens of the area. Cannibals who kidnap her and amputate one of her arms and one of her legs as a first course to the memorable sounds of Ace of Base. Most of the people in the area seem to have affiliated themselves with one of two camps. Either you're part of this cannibal bodybuilder community, which is the case for Jason Momoa, one of the other main characters, this character, who doesn't have a name, but I think has a tattoo that says Miami Man.
Yeah. I've got the same tattoo, so you can call me that.
Anytime. And then either that or you live in a town called Comfort, where on the plus side, there's no eating of people. On the downside, you're part of a drug sales supported cult run by Keanu Reeves as a character called The Dream, mm-hmm. who has a harem of gun-toting pregnant women and insists on nightly raves. No good choices, Matt. Everything bad. Matt, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night was an acclaimed breakout film. The Bad Batch has gotten a considerably more mixed reception. Do you see this as a case of a sophomore slump? Or is this one misunderstood?
Well, you just used the phrase. I'm writing it down so I could repeat it. No good choices. Everything bad. That's my review, ladies and gentlemen. Good night. I didn't like this movie. I was very disappointed by it. I was bored by a lot of it, frankly. And I strongly disliked it.
Interesting.
I can't remember the last time I have disliked a movie by a sort of respected up and coming filmmaker vetted by major festivals quite this much. I strongly disliked it. And I thought, let's start with the two leads. I thought were amongst the worst performances I have seen in this caliber of film. Jason Momoa's Cuban accent as the Miami man in this movie makes Al Pacino and Scarface look like a documentary. It is horrific. And I mean, you could be, I guess, outraged that he is not Cuban, but just as on an objective level, he sounds ridiculous. And every time he spoke, I slapped my forehead. I was groaning. I could not look at him as a character because he was just this big, ridiculous meathead Miami man talking in this ridiculous accent. And then the main actress, Suki Waterhouse, I'm not sure if I've seen her in anything else.
She's best known as a model.
Okay. I knew that she was a model. I looked up after the movie on Wikipedia. It didn't surprise me to learn she was British because she also has a... she's only lucky that Jason Momoa is next to her doing that Cuban accent because her accent isn't that much better. It's only better in comparison. But I just thought the two of them combined were just completely bereft of any interest whatsoever. And, you know, I think the world is potentially interesting that she has created. And obviously there are a lot of real world parallels and allegories and such that we can look at and see that I think give the movie, or could give the movie, if it was good, a certain cachet and relevance that would make it more interesting. But I just thought, like, what goes on in this world is so unbelievably boring and stupid and rambling and pointless that by the end of it, I was just like, that was it? I watched all of that for that? I was kind of upset.
No.
Are you getting that vibe?
I am. Am I being subtle? I appreciate that you're not mincing words.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, I will say this.
Yeah.
This movie is kind of a guilty pleasure for me.
Oh, uh-huh. No.
I know. I think it is a total hot mess of a movie.
Oh.
But there's something about Amanpour's kind of general sensibility. There's this like almost like teen goth romanticism that I think is like in both of her movies. I don't know if you've seen A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night.
I did, but I don't remember it all that. I saw
there's
it one
this,
time.
Like, there's a reason, I think. Like, both of her main characters in both of those movies have sequences where they're like just in their rooms, mm-hmm. like listening to music and mm-hmm. like putting up scrap photos on the wall and things. Like, and they're both like, you know, non-standard. They're not teenage girls. They are a vampire and an unwilling amputee in
sure.
a dystopian world. But there's still this like, yeah, this like kind of like luxuriant teenageness to I think like some of these imagery that I do enjoy. I think that whenever anyone opens their mouth in this movie,
yeah.
it is a bad
thing. It's bad.
But no one talks for a really long time.
I mean,
time.
That is true. There are long stretches where it's pretty quiet and,
right.
and the visual storytelling isn't bad. I'll give
it's
you that.
Bad. I think that, and more so in this than even her last film. Her last film had a kind of Jim Jarmusch quality to
totally.
It. This one feels more like a music video. And I think that there's
yeah,
like...
Yeah, or like Mad Max. I got a
sure,
real, like, I saw Mad
streak.
Max and
it's
wanted
kinda
to
like,
kind of homage
kinda like
it.
It's kind of like a Mad Max streak, but also it's like Mad Max by way of like, I don't know, Coachella.
Yeah, maybe a little Harmony Korine in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah,
I think that it's just like when she kind of like lets like music carry scenes mm-hmm. and kind of like just turns up this kind of like lushness and just like kind of lush sensibility. I do appreciate that. I think that like, she has something there.
Sure.
That I don't think that this movie manages to do anything with in a sustained sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed like the totally ridiculous look that Jason Momoa has going on in this movie. I adored.
I mean, the pants are kind of cool. I sort of liked his pants.
He wears like high-waisted dress pants.
Yes.
Like khaki dress pants.
Yeah, they're like slacks probably from like
right.
a suit
yes.
that has long since gone by the wayside.
Right. And then no shirt.
No shirt.
Has Miami Man in old English letters tattooed across
sure.
his chest alongside other tattoos.
Yes.
He is so buff that he looks like almost physically impossible.
Yeah, he's like Pain and Gain. He
yes.
looks like Mark Wahlberg. He ate Mark Wahlberg in Pain and Gain, basically.
And then he wears like a leather halter in which he has a hatchet.
Sure.
Yes.
Because he's a cannibal.
He's a cannibal. You
spoiler
know,
alert.
You gotta
have your tools.
Yeah, exactly.
For chopping people up.
But it is, and then he wears sunglasses.
And what about the accent?
And then the accent. I know. Every time he opens his mouth, I just like, oh god. It's just, it's so, I just don't know why, I feel like asking anyone to do that accent in general, I'm just like, you're asking so much from an actor.
Right.
And I just don't think that Jason Momoa is your guy.
Why couldn't he just have his normal accent? I get that part of it is, yeah,
right.
his character is an immigrant.
Yes.
Have him be an immigrant from somewhere else.
Right, I know. It's such a big ask, and he cannot do it.
No.
And I mean, the same way I think that you have Suki Waterhouse, who's British, trying to do, I think, like what's supposed to be a kind of like working class Texas accent.
It's like a Southern belle. It sounds
right.
to me like she's trying to, it's, you know, because there is sort of a Western vibe here. And it,
there is.
She does kind of sound like a classical figure of like a John Ford Western.
Sure. But then she's just so kind of inert an actress. Also.
Yeah, she's just not very present.
Right.
She just blank.
I mean, I think that's the thing is like she looks like you understand why she was chosen for like standing still on a desert landscape.
Right.
Like,
she has a striking look.
Yes.
And she sort of fits the world visually,
right.
but she's just not a great actress.
She's not. And like when so much of the movie requires you to want to just look at her
right.
to like have her be charismatic without speaking.
And to connect to her in some way, to feel something about this woman who's lost an arm and a leg.
Right. But that's the thing is like there are lots of times in the movie where she makes a choice and you don't understand why because
no.
she never lets you inside her head.
No.
This character, and I do think one of the best parts, the things this movie has to offer is that it dumps you into a scene that is so disturbing early
yeah,
on.
The beginning is the best part.
It is the best part.
Yeah.
Definitely. And I think that there is something about that kind of shock of having this character who is this like very traditionally pretty blonde girl and the kind who you almost like at the fact that she's scooped up and immediately used as meat.
Yeah.
There's something very like subversive about that just in terms of expectations in a dystopian movie.
Sure.
I
don't find myself disagreeing with much of what you're saying.
Sure.
I just feel like you're pointing out all the decent things sort of in the background of all these scenes terrible actors.
Sure. Beyond the terrible actors.
And even a story, there's really not that much
happens.
That happens.
I know. I think the thing for me, beyond even the fact that nothing much happened, because like her last movie I liked a lot and it was also just kind of drifty.
Right. It was a better mood piece though. This to me was a better mood piece.
One of the bigger problems of this movie is also that it sets up a world in which all of these people are put out and like forced out into this world to this landscape to survive for themselves
mm-hmm.
and yet you never really understand why some people get to go to comfort and why other
right.
people have to survive
by eating human flesh. in the wilderness. Yeah, totally. She has no interest in sort of explaining this world, which, you know, that's a thing. You know, that's viable. If you can pull that off in certain situations where the characters are really rich, the story is really gripping. But here, the most interesting thing is the world, which she then doesn't really fully tease out. So visually, it's a fascinating world.
Oh, it has incredible visuals.
Right. And like there's a scene where she's walking sort of down Main Street of Comfort and you're just seeing the different booths and like the economy of this place. And that's kind of interesting and fun. But that's about as much as we get of sort of understanding this place.
Right. And, you know, it sets up this kind of like I know that there were some people who this was brought up. Some people were disturbed by what they saw as the racial politics of this movie.
Yeah.
I think it's just too incoherent with regard to its racial 100%. Politics to really even make sense, especially since it almost sets up something with regard to like who has to be a cannibal and who's in comfort in terms of certainly like the women in Keanu Reeves's building.
Harem.
Yes, his harem of the dream inside me, literally. Yeah.
Teehee.
Yeah. But then it doesn't really follow through on that. So, and then the kind of like when there's a reveal about how comfort works, it seems like it should be a darker bargain.
Yeah, it's not shocking at all.
It's not shocking at all.
It's set up as like, this like gasp moment, and you're like, well, obviously.
Yeah,
isn't that how this would work?
You're like, why wouldn't you still stay?
Right.
You know, like this movie kind of suggests that like being a cannibal is this horrible choice to make, and yet it's still more honest than what is involved in being in comfort. But then you're like, no.
I'm not
eating
so
people
sure.
is horrible.
Yes.
It's portrayed so monstrously.
Like, yeah, it's not like it's
disturbing detail.
Right. It's not like they're like, actually, hear us out, cannibalism not that bad. That's not what this movie is about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I have to tell you, this is not entirely the movie's fault, but I feel like I'm getting a little sick of these like stunt casting things in these. It seems like it's happening a lot lately, and I don't know if it's because these movies are being like financed by like talent agencies, and so they're connecting like their bigger name stars with up and coming directors, and so you wind up with like a Jim Carrey in this movie,
right.
Basically unrecognizable as like this hermit who's sort of wandering through the desert. Does he have a line of dialogue? I mean,
I don't think he ever talks. He communicates with
he writes and stuff. Yeah. He seems mute. But just the idea of like casting Jim Carrey as a mute hermit who's not funny, who doesn't really have anything to do. He sort of serves a minor plot purpose, but there's no reason for it to be Jim Carrey. And you're like, oh, that was Jim Carrey.
I was looking up who the DJ was at the rave.
It was Diego Luna, right?
Diego Luna, yeah.
That's another one where it's like, if you could, I mean, why bother casting these, I guess, for name value on trailers and on posters and stuff? It's like, I don't know. There's been a lot of movies lately where very talented people are in it for 5 minutes. And I'm getting a little sick of sort of being kind of having the rug pulled out from under you where you think you're going to see someone who you like. I you know, and Jim Carrey could be good in this world. He sort of fits this world. But you got to give him something to do. That it's not that his part is necessarily bad, but it's just like, why? Why bother? Why did he bother? I guess he liked her last movie. I don't know.
That's a general feeling I get. That would be my guess. That would be my guess as to why Diego Luna turns up in this like
tiny
appearance. Yeah, I think that people just, I think it's partially that people want to have like kind of given something to this person who might go on to do big things.
Right.
So that you're there early and have a relationship.
So you can say.
Yeah.
So it's selfish.
I think, or maybe a favor to a friend. Who knows? Like,
right.
I don't, yeah.
Well, that's what I was sort of saying, like a favor to an agent.
Right, or maybe
like
to her.
That.
I don't know. She seems very
tied
into, yeah. What did you think of Keanu Reeves in that role?
I thought he was fine. You know, I love Keanu, and I was sort of excited when I knew he was in it, and I knew he had sort of like a kind of important supporting role. I didn't really think, you know, he has like a long speech about poop.
Yes, he does.
Which,
about what happens where your poop goes.
Right. Where if you like described, if you're like, here's the movie, and at one point in this movie, Keanu Reeves is going to give a long monologue about the inner workings of like plumbing, I would be like, here's all of my money. How soon can I see it? And then it's like a big nothing. It was very underwhelming. I mean, it was sort of fun to see him in the party as this really, you know, sort of like the mustache, the hair, the look is fun. I don't know. Again, the dialogue of this movie, even in Keanu's hands, is not its strength.
Yeah. And that said, even all of this said, I do still, there's still snippets of this movie I enjoy immensely. I love the scene where they run into a random guy who tries to trade gasoline for a limb to eat. And there's this whole, because I think in part there's almost no dialogue. The way that whole scene goes down, I really enjoyed. I even enjoy the kind of strange scene that for whatever reason has like birthed the image that was everywhere for this movie, which is when there's a sandstorm and the two main characters
they're
hide
under the blanket.
Yeah, and it's another wordless scene.
Yes.
This movie is vastly improved by the characters not having to talk and just standing there looking good.
That's a lovely moment. Visually, it's an eye-catching moment.
Yeah.
And you're right. They don't say anything, so that scene is a little bit better.
I like the ending, too. I like the kind of, like, punchline of the ending for me. There's also,
fine.
We didn't even mention this, but there's a little girl in this movie who's used as basically, like, a pawn for what plot there is.
Yes.
And she's not the strongest of child actors.
No.
Yeah. I don't know. It is definitely, it was a disappointment for me, but it is kind of a guilty pleasure for me as well, I will say.
It is not a guilty pleasure for me.
I accept that.
It is all Bad Batch for me, 100%. I was not happy.
That is the Bad Batch, and you can find it on Netflix.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So we are talking cannibal movies on this episode, an enduring topic, let's say. It's been definitely in some kind of classics of exploitation and horror. But I would also say it's kind of cannibalism is totally hot right now. It's been a trend. Someone noted at last year's Cannes that there were 5 films with cannibalism themes, including Neon Demon, which we've talked about on an episode before, Slack Bay, which I mentioned, which is newly added to Netflix, Raw, which was also newly added to Netflix, and we can come back to later in this episode, and then all of the kind of like zombie-related ones, you know, Train to Busan, but the girl with all the gifts, a film
like
that you've talked about a lot before. On TV, there's Santa Clarita Diet.
Right.
It's kind of been a...
The cannibals are hot right now.
I think it's a handy metaphor.
For
anything.
For anything.
It's a lot of things. It's interesting to me that at Cannes, apparently, the producer of Slack Bay was talking about it as this income gap metaphor, the haves and have-nots, which definitely, I think I've seen it used, and I think one of my picks
uses it that way.
Uses it as a metaphor for that. But it's also, I think, a handy metaphor for, like, appetites or desire run wild or other things.
Yes, that certainly applies to one of my picks for sure.
Yeah. And it's also just like, it's still such a lingering taboo.
It's a taboo, right? That's what I would say is that, you know, we as a society are exposed to so much horror, not just fictional, non-fictional horror these days, that it can be tough to shock people. And the idea of eating people is still shocking, thankfully.
Yes.
Thankfully,
we haven't
normalized eating people yet. So it is still a shocking thing.
Yes.
And so I think you're right. I think that that might be part of it. And also that, I mean, that we these things happen in waves. You know, like there's a wave of vampire movies. There's a wave of zombie movies. There's a wave of, you know, like, so it could just be the cannibals' turn.
Yeah.
And in 5 years, there'll be no cannibal movies and they'll be on to the next thing. And then in 25 years, the people are like, you know, we haven't seen in a while, cannibal movies. And then they'll be back again.
Sure. Well, cannibals, having a moment right now.
Yes.
But my first pick is actually not from right now.
Oh.
It is from 1989.
Mm.
It is
a great year for people eating.
It must be. Every year is a good year for people eating, apparently. It's Brian Usna's directorial debut, Society, which is now streaming on Amazon, starring Baywatch's own Billy Warlock as a Beverly Hills high school kid whose seemingly idyllic life is disrupted by this underlying feeling that he doesn't really belong. And yeah, sure, same as all of us. Welcome to being a teenager, or for that matter, welcome to being a human being. Yes. Except no, not in Bill Whitney's case. In Bill Whitney's case, he's right. There is something very strange and disturbing going on with his family and with their powerful, wealthy friends. What is so epic, and I think what makes Society work so well and be so kind of like bitingly funny as well as disturbing, is that it has the same slightly cheeseball look and feel of any other 80s teen movie. Bill's girlfriend is this blonde cheerleader with fluffy hair who's very concerned with her own social standing and in school. Bill runs for student body president against a bow tie wearing nerd. And yet Bill keeps getting signs that something is wrong, especially with his family, his like chipper yuppie parents and the sister that they seem to prefer. Society kind of follows along the lines of a paranoid alien invasion thriller, combined with this touch of like, maybe the problem is me, delusional possibility. Except in this case, there is no invading force. In the last half hour, Bill finds out not only that he's been right, that something is wrong, but that the scary truth has been there all along. And he finds out in the most spectacularly disgusting phantasmagoria of body horror effects imaginable. Really just like a kind of amazing last half hour. In which it turns out that the high society his family is a part of literally feasts off those with lower social standing.
Delicious.
Sucking nutrients out of them in these grotesque semi-sexual orgies.
Wow.
In which their bodies
going there.
Warp and blend together in something that would really make David Cronenberg proud. The rich really are different from you and me, Matt.
Turns out.
And the effects were done by Joji Tani, a.k.a. Screaming Mad George. And they are practical effects. And in that way of practical effects, they hold up horrifyingly well. And it's in part because they don't try and mimic anything sensical. They are like this total nightmare. All of the imagery that in that sequence is a total nightmare, including someone reaching a hand up through someone's, like what's implied to be their anus, through their body and up through their mouth.
Definitely going to be the most explicit episode.
Yes.
On iTunes.
Like fingers out of their mouth, like they turn someone into this like flesh sock. It's really something that I had trouble getting out of my head. But it's also incredibly imaginatively impressively disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sure. it's you know, metaphor here, pretty clear. Feasting on the poor, rich, this whole separate breed. You have to be born that way. You can't just get by sucking, you know, nutrients out of someone like they're some delicious piece of fruit you can kind of turn into just skin. But yeah, if you want some imagery you will never ever be able to forget, no matter how much you try.
Yeah.
I would suggest Society on Amazon. It's as much a dark comedy as it is horror. And it's really something else.
Wow. Well, I always wondered how many episodes it would take for us to use the phrase flesh sock on the air. That's 148. But we made it.
I'm glad.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
We finally reached that plateau.
I'm very proud.
Yes, you should be. Well, my first pick, you know, it's funny. My first pick is kind of a dark comedy as well. There's something, I guess, maybe because it is such a taboo that there is something to be.
It has to like relieve the pressure, the tension a little bit.
Yes, perhaps. So my first pick is a strange but oddly satisfying period cannibalism comedy called Ravenous from 1999. It was directed by Antonia Bird, but she was actually, and I did not know this until this week, she was actually a last-minute replacement for the original director. Milko Manchevsky was fired a few weeks into production, and the film does have this vibe of not quite knowing what it is, but it sort of works. It's so weird and strange and unexpected in the turns that it takes, that these things that probably should be flaws in some ways makes it very endearing. And the only thing I could think to compare it to would be, well, it's not modern day anymore because this movie is almost 20 years old, but sort of an update of a Roger Corman Poe movie, because you have these great actors in period costumes. There's some grisly kind of bloody horror. Some of it doesn't look all that convincing. And then there is this real sort of very dark sense of humor, too. The film is set in the 1840s. You have this army officer played by Guy Pearce. He is punished for his cowardice in this battle, and I think the Mexican-American War. And as punishment, he is set to this remote fort, and he meets this motley crew of characters who I think you're supposed to want to see eaten, which is sort of part of the fun, is some of them are very unlikable. You have Jeffrey Jones, Neil McDonough, David Arquette. The movie almost wants you to like be excited when David Arquette gets eaten. Spoiler alert. And Jeremy Davies as well. This guy wanders into the fort. He claims that his wagon train was, I don't know, taken captive by cannibals. He's the only survivor, but it is a trap, of course. And he brings all of these people. It's Robert Carlyle is the guy here who brings all these members of the fort back for this delicious trap. Now, part of what makes this movie special, I would say. Have you seen Ravenous?
It's been a long time since I've seen it, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Yes.
See, I don't think I had ever seen the whole thing. I had seen it on cable and such, but I don't think I'd ever seen the whole thing until yesterday. And what makes this movie magical is that there is like a magical element to it. It's not just about eating man meat. There is this idea in the film. We learn this legend of the Wendigo. The Wendigo. This creature or this idea that eating man makes you like almost like Wolverine. Like it gives you superpowers and you could heal injuries. You can like be almost dead. But if you eat a person, you're suddenly like magically healed. And I just thought this was the greatest thing I'd ever seen in my life. It's just so silly. And, you know, it's like it's not just that eating human flesh is a taboo. It's unholy. And I also liked it because I feel like we should apply this theory to all animals. So like when I eat a cheeseburger and afterwards I'm like really like sluggish, it's not because of the fat and the sodium or whatever. It's because I have absorbed the essence of this cow. Cows are very sluggish and they're probably very sweaty. I don't know
why you're being so harsh on cows.
I'm very anti-cow. But I just like this idea that like you absorb the essence of something. You are what you eat. It's like the most literal, ridiculous version of that.
You just like suck someone's essence and you're
right. So if
stronger
I
eat, for
right.
it.
And so if I had some baby back ribs, that explains why afterwards I like to roll around in mud, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but you like to do that anyway.
I know, but I'm just trying to find an excuse, okay?
I appreciate that.
The film, it has this really kind of dry, dark sense of humor. It's got this big score. It has people like biting into human flesh and then like getting into fights.
The fights are, I think, the highlight, really.
Yes,
because people can't necessarily hurt themselves, like
right,
hurt each other.
Right, because they're like Wolverine.
Yeah.
It's like if Wolverine, instead of being a mutant, the reason he was strong was he ate people. It's so silly. Anyway, I had seen like bits and pieces of this on HBO and cable through the years, but I don't think I'd ever seen the whole thing. It is a hoot. It is really funny, even though no one is everyone's playing it very straight, but it's just so like goofy. Like this notion of cannibals are like superpower people, I just thought was amazing. And I'm really glad I watched it. I had a fabulous time. I recommend it. Ravenous. It is available right now on Netflix.
It's worth
we might have
out.
Fought over who got to talk about this
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, I do enjoy that movie.
Oh, it was
but
great.
I also enjoy my next movie, which is not a dark comedy, though I would say it has a unique sensibility all of its own. This would be Claire Denis' 2001 film Trouble Every Day, which is streaming on Amazon. And it's about how it's about two couples, and it's about how two halves of each couple find themselves gripped by this urge to consume human flesh. As you do. But it's a movie that puts the cannibalistic urge right up next to desire, sexual desire, in this way that is impossibly memorable, in part because of how beautifully and disturbingly certain tableaus are set up here. So one of the couples is the Browns, Shane Brown, a doctor played by Vincent Gallo, in one of his, like, I think, kind of defining roles. Who's just been married to June, played by Tricia Vessey, this kind of delicate-seeming young woman who we see in certain scenes. She's like a bite mark on her arm, and there's a part where she has like a kind of wound on her lip that suggests that her new husband maybe doesn't always have the best control. They're headed to Paris, where Leo, played by Alex Descartes, has been laying low with his wife, Corée, played by Beatrice Dahl, in one of her most memorable roles. She's just like this feral creature. It's kind of amazing. And he keeps her locked in the house because when she roams free, she has this tendency to seduce random men and then kill them in spectacularly gross ways. Shane has passed the trip off as a honeymoon, but what he really wants is to see Corée again. There's like some time in the past, he and Leo worked together and he became obsessed with Corée. And there is this suggestion in the film, which is like kind of very elliptical and never fills in all of the information, that Shane and Corée are infected in some way, or maybe that these urges were released as part of an experiment, but maybe they're not. You know, the movie uses this cannibalistic urge, one that Corée wants to indulge in and that Shane keeps trying to fight with like pills and willpower and withholding himself from his bewildered wife, as this kind of metaphor for sexual dissatisfaction, for this kind of unfulfilled sexual need, whether it's problems with fidelity and monogamy, or whether it's a search for some experience that that your partner can't fulfill. Like, both of these characters are, like, and I think, like, one of the things that makes this movie so kind of sad, there's this real element of, like, pain running through it that beyond the pain inflicted on other people, is that these are both, like, loving relationships in which one partner feels still unsatisfied, you know? Like, Shane, having married someone, arranges for a way to go see this woman from his past that he was obsessed with. And Corey has these, like, scenes that are very tender with her husband, and then goes off and has these, like, very disturbing sequences of, like, luring in men whose tongue she rips out. You know, I think that this film, like The Bad Batch, actually, goes wordless for long stretches, and it does not have bad performances in it. It has some remarkably expressive ones, and also leans heavily on the music of the Tindersticks. But I think that there's something about it that's, like, so haunting, because it does seem to express, without setting up a direct metaphor, this, like, terrible dread of feeling that, you know, these characters having these sexual desires that can't be kind of, like, crammed down into this relationship that they've chosen to have. And I think that's maybe simplifying it a little, but it is, like, a really haunting, troubling, beautiful movie. And I'm a big fan of Claire Denis, but I think this one is one of my favorites of hers. It's Trouble Every Day, and it is on Amazon.
All right. My second pick probably doesn't get classified as a cannibalism movie in the same way some of the other movies we've talked about. But, I mean, it might be, or it might have, the most famous movie cannibal of all time. And that would be Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter, one of the main characters of The Silence of the Lambs, the 1991 classic from the late, great Jonathan Demme. You have Hannibal Lecter, played by Anthony Hopkins in the role that won him an Oscar. He is incarcerated at the beginning of the film because of past crimes, and he becomes a key source of information for Clarice, the FBI trainee played by Jodie Foster, who's assigned to the case of another serial killer named Buffalo Bill. And, you know, it's funny to take a look at some of Silence of the Lambs after watching Ravenous and sort of applying the mythology of, like, Wendigo superhero flesh eaters, where, you know, they don't really make anything of Hannibal Lecter, like, gaining powers from eating flesh.
But he's pretty powerful guy.
Yes, that's sort of my point, is that there is something here. There is this idea that he is sort of, like, superhuman, his intellect, even his, like, refinement, you know?
Right, I'd say even more so in the follow-ups. He becomes,
yes,
like...
in Hannibal.
He almost is
like a superhero. He's like Batman.
Yeah.
He's like Batman if Batman, like, Batman is a vampiric character, so it just sort of takes it to that place, basically. So what I'm saying is that maybe The Silence of the Lambs is actually a Ravenous. I can't tell if it would be a prequel or a sequel. It happened before, but it's set afterwards.
I thought you were going to go with maybe Batman eats people, but that's also good.
That would be an interesting place for the next... I'd like to see Ben Affleck's Batman doing that. I'm not saying I'd be opposed to it. I mean, that would explain why he's so sad. It's really hard being Batman. Why did you say that name? Yeah, and then he'd eaten Martha. They realized they'd eaten Martha. Anyway, one of the things that is so, like, brilliant about Sounds of the Lambs, and I feel like as the years go by, it kind of only gets more meaningful, is how, you know, it's a movie about these over-the-top serial killers, but it really is so much from the Jodie Foster character's perspective and being a woman in this very male-dominated world. Just the way her character is introduced at the FBI training facility, how she's framed in the movie, and you look at all the shots where she's, like, dwarfed by these men who are not necessarily, you know, they're the good guys, they're the FBI, but they loom over her, and she just seems, you know, so much smaller. And so, you know, like, the cannibalism of Hannibal Lecter, the stuff that Buffalo Bill does, it almost seems like it's this continuum. It's like this, they're the extreme, but that there is this all, that it represents, like, the most extreme expression of this sort of aggression or this threat that's sort of ever present in her world.
He also, Hannibal Lecter, sees her more clearly and understands her situation more clearly than certainly any of her coworkers.
That is true as well. That's right. So, I have to, of course, mention the... Maybe there's a more famous line, but I couldn't think of one. A more famous cannibal line in the history of cannibal movies than, "I do wish we could chat longer, but I'm having an old friend for dinner." That's pretty good. It doesn't get much better than that. If you want to hear more about Silence of the Lambs and Michael Mann's Manhunter, which is, of course, like a prequel, sort of, and the history of Hannibal Lecter on screen, we did a whole episode on that way back on Film Spotting SVU number 65, which you can find on our website, filmspottingsvu.com. And Silence of the Lambs is currently available on Hulu. All right, let's talk about some new movies currently in theaters before we get to Behind the Eight Ball. I think we can't let it slip away without discussing Blade Runner 2049. There's certainly a lot to talk about.
If
we're allowed now. Well, the film is, by the time you're listening to it, the film is now in release. So yes. I think we'll be discussing some specifics. If you want to remain totally unspoiled, you can fast forward, I don't know, 5 minutes or so. And then we're going to talk about Professor Marston and The Wonder Woman very briefly, which is opening in theaters this coming weekend. And Allison and I have both seen. So let's talk about Blade Runner 49. Here comes some spoilers, potentially, at a certain point. But Allison, did you enjoy Blade Runner 2049?
An exquisitely beautiful movie that I think just felt so empty inside to me.
Aww.
Yeah, I was really disappointed by this because I just felt like... I mean, in ways, you know, we talked about in Blade Runner we talked about in Bad Batch that like the world is the most interesting part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that way so strongly with this, where I felt like all of the characters kind of felt like these, I don't know, like barely sketched in ways to find your way through the story. And the world, I love like the futuristic world of like the LA of Blade Runner. Like it, and I loved getting to see more of it in this movie, especially in a movie as thoughtfully and carefully art directed as this one is. But I was so impatient with all of the actual characters on screen. You, having written a piece about how you've never loved the original Blade Runner,
I haven't.
And won the love of the internet with that, of course.
Mm-hmm, of course.
You were a fan of this one.
I like this movie a lot better than the original one. And having just... I've only seen Blade Runner 2049 once. I would love to have the time to see it again. It's a long movie. But having like then rewatched the original Blade Runner, like my opinion of that movie, like it's... probably like if I made a list of movies I want to love but don't, like it would definitely be like number one on the list. Because I admire it, I enjoy looking at it, but it just leaves me so, it leaves me the way that this movie left you, guess. It just, that movie leaves me so cold, and this movie, I just loved how, you know, as you said, thoughtfully art directed, it's such a beautiful movie. I loved exploring this world with Ryan Gosling, his character, Kay, and, you know, like all these interesting little characters. All the people that we meet love the replicant sort of bodyguard of Jared Leto's character, who's the sort of modern day replicant creator, who I didn't love him so much. I thought he was sort of the weak link.
No, he's definitely the weak link.
But I thought Sylvia Hoax as Love was amazing. I thought she was fast, like just her presence was so striking and interesting. Like, give her her own movie as this character. I would totally watch that character doing just like working in that office. Like, she's got stories to tell working for Jared Leto's character for sure. And it's funny because I'm not a huge fan of Harrison Ford in the original movie. Like, I feel like he's like not very good in the original Blade Runner. He's kind of underwhelming. I don't really think he knew how to play that character. And here I was like blown away by how good he is in this movie. I was like, oh my God, he's acting. Like, I just figured he was going to show up and be like, I get off my replicant, you know, but he gives a performance here. He's not in a ton of the movie. It takes a long time for him to show up. But when he shows up, he's like, I thought he was really good. Like, I actually got caught up in his story in a way I never was caught up in the Deckard story back in the day in the old Blade Runner, where, you know, the whole question of is he a replicant, is he not, I never really cared that much because the character wasn't that interesting to me. I found myself a lot more interested this time about that question alone.
I just, see, I didn't care about that at all. I kept waiting for, I don't know, especially like Gosling is playing, I think, a variation on a type of character he's played like recently a lot, especially in like Nicholas Winding Refn movies and I'd say a bit of Derek C. of France movies as well. This kind of like sad-eyed, like kind of emblem of romantic masculinity. This kind of like, just like stands kind of like in the rain looking droopy a lot. And I just
But
like,
he looks so good looking
he
droopy.
He does look good, but I feel
that
like
coat.
I just,
didn't you want to wear that
sure,
coat
but
forever?
He's just so, he's like almost catatonic in this movie.
Oh, I didn't
just
think
like,
so at all.
I found him so kind of tiresome.
It's funny because I wasn't, you're right. He does do those movies. I was just thinking of him in like La La Land and how completely different he is here. And just, I loved watching him in this world because, you know, here's the big spoiler that they is literally in the first scene of the movie that they didn't want anyone to discuss is that, as you know, like instead of being like, is he a replicant? Is he not a replicant? In this movie, they're like, he's a replicant.
Right.
And so you get to sort of see the world through this character's eyes. And I thought he did a great job because he has to be sort of so kind of, he is sort of subdued. And then over the course of the movie, he learns these things and it like opens him up in this fascinating, I thought it was fascinating to watch his journey.
I wanted more of the experience of being a replicant in a way that I just felt like this movie didn't give me much. Aside, I mean, from the scenes with Ana de Armas, who's
I loved all that stuff.
I think those are Joy. The most interesting ones. As Joy, who is like this, this is another supposed spoiler,
right?
Though it's who her character is. She's an AI program, like a basically companion program.
She's Siri with a body.
Right. And that
it's like the computer from her with the body.
Right.
A hologram,
right.
A holographic projection body.
And she's like the only company that he has in his private life.
Right.
And there is something about that. And I wanted so much more of like what's kind of hinted at there, where he is a replicant and this new model replicant that's like more obedient, you know, kind of created to fix the problems of the last ones who kept running away because they were being used as like slave labor for extremely dangerous jobs.
Right.
So he understands that he is kind of like his questions of his free will are up in the air. Right. And yet his only companion is this kind of fragment of a personality who also does not have free will.
Yeah.
And like the bits in which they deal with that they're almost like, he is kind of a shell of a full person, and then she is like even more so, are by far the most interesting part of the movie for me. And I wish that it explored more of that. But I felt like instead it kind of uses it again for like these like very beautiful visuals that just didn't feel very kind of like meaningful to me beyond their effect and like the gorgeous stills. But we should wrap this up and move on. But like, I did want to ask you this. We've just mentioned two things that the studios asked us to keep quiet.
Sure.
Spoilers.
Yes.
And that are like basic facts of the movie.
Correct.
Like, do you think that hurt Blade Runner in terms of marketing?
I don't know. I think what hurt this movie is that Blade Runner is a cult film.
Sure.
That
was not a success in the box office when it came out.
Right. This movie has already made more money than the original Blade Runner made in its entire theatrical run. And this movie didn't do all that great. So that tells you that, you know, the audience, I think, was kind of limited. I think Blade Runner is a movie, you know, like I've seen it a lot of times, but I think Blade Runner is a movie that everyone knows, but I don't think a lot of people have actually seen, and even less people really like.
Right. Like it's got cult fandom. It doesn't have like beloved sci-fi fandom.
It's not
in
like
the same
remaking
way.
Ghostbusters, which, by the way, didn't work out all that well for the financiers either. But Ghostbusters is a movie that of that era that everyone has seen and loves and quotes. Like nobody like quotes Blade Runner. Nobody
except for when someone might want to quote the Roy Batty
the tears.
Speech,
yeah, you're right. Okay, so yeah, but you don't do that in your day to day life unless
I
you're
hope
a
not.
Weird person.
I really hope you don't.
But you also
actually,
like
I hope you do.
But like I mean, like I, it's not a movie that people like dress up as for Halloween. It's not a or a cosplay as like, very rarely. It doesn't have action figures. It doesn't have.
It doesn't have the same kind of place.
The
in,
cultural
in
footprint.
Popular fandom, right?
Right,
and culture that. Star Wars or something. Does.
Right.
Sure.
To me, like, if I was in charge of a studio saying, like, should we make another Blade Runner? I would be like, absolutely, but we can only spend X amount. And when I saw they spent $150 million on this, I mean, God bless them. The movie looks amazing. I'm so glad it exists. But, in what world does that make sense financially? It just seems like the movie was doomed to make, like, $75 million.
Sure. I do think that,
and
actually
become a cult film on video.
I do think that the spoilers were actually, I think, part of the reason that they misunderstood the movie they were putting out. Or, like, kind of, which is to say, like to say that you can't say that the main character is a replicant, a fact that is revealed in the first scene in the movie, because right. that's a spoiler. I think that is to assume that people are so on board with your property already.
They don't care what it's about.
They don't need to know what the movie is about.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, that's not true for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that, like, letting people in to be like, here's why you would want to watch this movie, even if you are unfamiliar with this property. I do not think that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, I don't like to make a really, really expensive cult movie like this, which is, I think, sort of what they've done. I mean, it's they kind of like wrote themselves into this corner.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I don't know. I can't imagine people hearing what it was specifically about and going, oh, now I want to see it. I have a hard time believing it would make a big difference.
I feel like if you don't know what Blade Runner is, I just like, why would you, I guess, go see this?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk briefly about Professor Marston and the Wonder Women.
Yes.
This is Angela Robinson's film about William Marston, who was the creator of Wonder Woman.
Yes.
So it's a biopic that happens to have excellent timing.
Fabulous timing.
I had not known much about this story. I'd known a little bit. I'd not known about the fact that this Marston had this polyamorous relationship
right.
With these two women. And that is definitely the focus of this movie. And I thought that seeing that kind of explored it, with the sheen of like any other glossy biopic was fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Though that also got frustrating after a while.
Yeah. To me, that was kind of one of the interesting things about it was that it looks like a very typical biopic about like literally like this healthy and happy three-way polyamorous long-term relationship
with mild kink explorations into kink,
very mild. The reason that I liked that watching it just as an observer was I felt like I think part of what Angela Robinson was doing with this movie was to say that these people are normal people that we're not supposed to look at them as strange or weird or like she didn't like, you know, like the Paul Verhoeven version of this story would be a lot different. And that you can say, well, the sex scenes or the way that they're depicted, it can be quote unquote boring. But I felt like that was sort of the point in a way. Like she didn't want to sensationalize these people. She wanted to treat them like, you know, healthy, normal, good people. And treat it the way you would any other biopic, as if to not like stigmatize it in any way. So
yeah,
I thought that was sort of interesting.
Yeah, but it is treated like a biographical love story.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
No different than any other heterosexual biographical love story.
Right. But then it does kind of have that like that bit of like frustrating inertness of any biopic where you're
absolutely.
Kind of like
that's the sort of that's the flip side that's a problem.
Of it, where you're like this there's a little bit of lifelessness to it. These characters always seem to kind of like you know, be like wearing full faces of makeup and always like everything looks really nice. And
time starts to jump very, you know, like I think the most interesting thing about the movie is not anything to do with Wonder Woman. So if
which is like left towards the end
yes. The most interesting stuff is that, I mean, Professor Marston, before he created Wonder Woman, like was like a psychology professor and helped create the lie detector. And so there are these scenes where they're testing the lie detector, which are kind of sexy and interesting.
And it like ties into the idea of the lasso, the kind of
golden lasso of truth where you're tied up in this thing or you're hooked up in it and you have to tell the truth or it's going to. The needle's gonna jump. And like that stuff and the early stages of their relationship are a lot more interesting than they were a happy
right domesticity
couple. Domesticity, right, exactly. And then the stuff with Wonder Woman I found kind of, I don't know, a little underwhelming. It's more interesting to see how all of that stuff was seeded in their lives than it is to have the guy actually writing it. And there's this whole frame story that I don't think actually you need and doesn't make any sense.
It's very biopic-y and it is unnecessary.
Yeah. But I liked it. Overall, I thought it was a good film and good performances. Rebecca Hall is awesome in it.
She is very good in it. I would say this is you can really feel that there is a female director in this movie. Mm-hmm. I feel like there is something, I think that having kind of like a female gaze approach to it really makes a big difference in this mm-hmm. case, because I think that there is a male gazy version of a story about a guy who ends up in a relationship with two women.
No good. That's a problem.
Would probably not focus so much on the women.
No.
Yeah.
That's fair. All right. Well, let's get to Behind the Eight Ball, where we wrap things up on the show by running down some new releases on streaming. Some listener recommendations that you wonderful people have sent to us at our email address, svu@filmspottingsvu.com. And then finally, one film chosen blindly by number from our My Lists on Netflix. Allison, who's going first this time?
I'm going to go first.
All right. Well, let's start with three new releases on streaming.
Okay. First up, new to Netflix is The Ornithologist. That's Joao Pedro Rodriguez's award-winning psychosexual queer biblical allegory about a man whose trip studying birds in northern Portugal takes some very strange turns. It's a movie I missed on the festival circuit, and I'm really looking forward to catching up with. I've heard it is very, like, it is very unusual, but very compelling. New to Netflix as well is April and the Extraordinary World. It's one of a bunch of G-Kids releases added to the streaming service recently. G-Kids has a lot of animated film releases, especially a lot of the international animated films, which is the case with this one, a French-Belgian production that is set in an alternate steampunk Europe. With a female scientist lead, a talking cat, houses that transform into rockets, and all kinds of other wonders. It's pretty delightful. That's on Netflix. And to Sundance Now is Hong Kong Trilogy. This is a docu-fiction film directed by the legendary cinematographer Christopher Doyle. And he looks at three generations in Hong Kong, the city he has photographed so famously in multiple Wong Kar-wai films. The first looks at children in an elementary school. The second looks at adults involved in the city's umbrella revolution. And the third looks at senior citizens doing some speed dating. And that is on Sundance Now.
How about two listener recommendations?
So first up, we've got a recommendation from Jennifer, who actually sent us in a few horror recommendations from on Shudder. Unfortunately, they're no longer streaming on Shudder, but one of them is streaming on Netflix, so we will read that one. Jennifer writes, I'm a huge horror fangirl, and she recommends Baskin, a Turkish sort of zombie occult WTF torture film. A group of police officers investigate something, and bad things happen. Sometimes hard to follow, but the visuals are stunning. Reminds me a little of Kill List. Thoroughly enjoyed this one. And hey, horror from Turkey. That's novel. So that is Baskin, and that is streaming on Netflix. Thank you for that, Jennifer. And second, we have one from Justin in Toronto, who writes, I wanted to spread my love for Line of Duty, which has its first three glorious BBC short seasons on Netflix in Canada, at least. Here in the US, it's on Hulu. Line of Duty is the best police procedural of all time. I don't say that lightly. I am a 45-year-old man and well-traveled connoisseur of cop dramas on both sides of the Atlantic and around the world. Yet Jed Mercurio's over-the-top saga of the team from AC-12, Anti-Corruption Unit 12, aka Internal Affairs, sets a new standard for outrageously fun, self-righteous, oh no they didn't episode climaxes, and turn-on-a-dime plot machinations. It's basically a three-hander with the hotshot DS Steve Arnott, the dedicated DC Kate Fleming, and everyone wishes they had a boss like him, Superintendent Ted Hastings, played with devastating pathos and Irish charm by Adrian Dunbar. Each six-episode season follows a single investigation into police misconduct that leads from a lower-level copper to a more sinister conspiracy at the top. The pace is relentless and feels more like a Hong Kong cop noir than Agatha Christie or Inspector Morse. I defy anyone to dislike it. Season 4 has already aired in the UK and stars an electrifying Tandy Newton as a senior investigator who slowly unravels under the anti-corruption microscope, hoping it comes to Netflix soon as I'm dying to rewatch. Justin in Toronto, you have totally sold me on this. That was an excellent recommendation.
It's electrifying.
Thank you.
All right, and how about one film chosen finally by number from your My List on Netflix?
You gave me number 15. Mm-hmm. Number 15 is something I actually deleted because I've already watched.
Oh.
It is American Vandal. This would be the Dan Perot and Tony Yacenda original Netflix series.
Oh, right.
That is a kind of a mockumentary in the style of Making a Murder or
Serial. Right. I heard about this.
And it surrounds a high school prank in which someone draws penises on various faculty cars and is expelled. The class clown is expelled for this. Mm-hmm. And then the media team in school starts this documentary to look into whether or not he did it.
Ah.
And it's actually pretty good.
How many episodes?
Eight
is it?
Episodes.
Okay.
It goes
half
down
hour
pretty
or
easily.
Hour?
I think they're all around the half hour, maybe 45 minute mark.
Okay.
But they do, it is both like a very great look at true crime conventions in the kind of like new resurgence of true crimes, mm-hmm. especially the kind of like questioning the transparency with regard to journalistic practices and people putting themselves in the story. And mm-hmm. then it's also just like a pretty good story about high school and like high school teenage boys, like, and about how they behave. So I was actually pretty impressed by it. It's worth a look. It's surprising. It's American Vandal, and that is on Netflix. Matt,
yes,
are you ready?
Yes.
Well, then give me three new releases.
All right. First up, available on Netflix just a few weeks after its 20th anniversary, is Boogie Nights. I can't believe this movie is 20 years old. Paul Thomas Anderson's film about the rise and fall of a uniquely gifted porn star named Dirk Diggler, played by a young and shockingly great Mark Wahlberg. I recently saw this movie for the first time in many years, and for the first time ever, on the big screen in 35mm, and it holds up very well. The performances, the writing, the technical camera work, just one of the all-time great movies of my adulthood. I love this movie if you've never seen it. Boogie Nights on Netflix. Next up on Tubi TV is Infernal Affairs, the terrific Hong Kong action thriller that inspired The Departed. In Martin Scorsese's version, it's about, it's the two moles, right? You got the undercover cop hiding in the gang and the gangster who has managed to infiltrate the upper echelon of law enforcement. Scorsese's cast was great, but Infernal Affairs is not too shabby either. Tony Leung plays the undercover cop. Andy Lau is the mole among the cops. You also have Anthony Wong in an important supporting role. If you're a fan of The Departed, you should totally check it out. Even if you haven't seen The Departed, check it out. It is it's really great. I can't vouch for the sequels. I've never seen either of the sequels.
I don't remember them very well. I feel like yes.
Well, one is like a prequel, one is a prequel
sequel. I feel like I've seen the sequel and it's good.
Just see this one. Infernal Affairs, available on Tubi TV. And finally available on Netflix, I have Before Midnight, the third film in Richard Linklater, Ethan Hawke, and Julie Delpy's decade-spanning chronicle of unlikely love between an American man and a French woman. They met on a train traveling through Europe in Before Sunrise. 9 years later, in Before Sunset, they reconnected in Paris. Now, in Before Midnight, they are married with twin girls. After two of the most gloriously romantic movies ever made, comes a much more realistic look at relationships. I recently interviewed Richard Linklater for his new film, Last Flag Flying. The topic of a potential fourth film came up. I would definitely say he made it sound like it is conceivable. They like wait 5 years after the last movie to discuss whether they might make a new one. And he said they're getting close to discussing whether there could be either a new movie or just some other project they could all do together. So we shall see. In the meantime, Before Midnight is available on Netflix.
Okay, give me two listener recommendations.
All right, I'm actually giving you two here from Dave in Charlotte, North Carolina, who gave us two recommendations together as a kind of double feature, so let's just use them both. Dave writes, I came across this Netflix pair, totally by accident, and actually watched them both on back-to-back nights. Number one is actually the first two episodes titled True East, of a new documentary series called The Confession Tapes. It deals with two Seattle teenagers accused in the horrifying triple murder of one boy's family. The police seize on the boys as suspects and hold them for questioning in a hotel room, but the teens flee to Canada because one of them is Canadian. Both are highly intelligent but are viewed as suspect because they read Nietzsche. Canadian police use questionable tactics to get them to confess. It's a fascinating true story. Number two is the 1959 film Compulsion, which is also currently streaming on Netflix. It's a classic film, but I had never seen it. It's based on the Leopold and Loeb murder case in Chicago. The two young men are also highly intelligent and read Nietzsche, and police use questionable tactics to get a confession. Orson Welles comes on the scene late in the film as their defense lawyer and gives an amazing closing argument in the film that must last for 15 minutes. All four main actors are tremendous. Dean Stockwell and Bradley Dillman as the murderers and E.G. Marshall as the prosecutor, along with Wells as the defense attorney. It's a pretty amazing film. So that's Compulsion and The Confession Tapes, both available on Netflix. Thank you, Dave in Charlotte, for those recommendations.
Okay, give me one from your Netflix, my list.
You gave me number eight, and number eight on my list is Prohibition, a film by Ken Burns and Lynn Navis. Ken Burns' documentary traces the passage of the 18th Amendment and the social and legal effects of prohibiting alcohol and the repeal of prohibition. Ken Burns, I believe, has a new documentary series out right now
on
Vietnam. And so you know how this goes. You see, oh, someone has a new thing, and you look on Netflix and you go, oh, Prohibition. I never watched that one. And so I added it a little while ago. I haven't seen all of Ken Burns' work, but some of them are very good. If you're in the mood for his thing, he does a very good... His baseball documentary is incredible. That's my favorite.
I also have heard many people mention to me recently that they fall asleep to Ken Burns, like it's soothing.
I could see that.
Yes.
Totally. Totally. Well, maybe the next time I'm feeling a little insomniacal, I'll put on Prohibition on Netflix. We have three very appealing and very horrifying options for our listener's choice review next time. It's Halloween season. It's October. It's the perfect time to do a horror movie. So we've got three horror movies to choose from here. I have the first one. It is Gerald's Game. This is a Netflix original. It's a Netflix original film now on Netflix. I will read you. There's two different plot descriptions I found on Netflix. I'll read you both of them. Two for the price of one. Lingerie and handcuffs were meant to spice up their weekend getaway. Instead, they surfaced a wife's darkest fears. And now here's the other one. When her husband's sex game goes wrong, Jesse, handcuffed to a bed in a remote lake house, ooh, like the lake house, faces warped visions, dark secrets, and a dire choice. And it has Carla Gugino and Bruce Greenwood. It's directed by Mike Flanagan, who's a well-respected director of little horror movies like Oculus and Hush and Ouija, Origin of Evil, which I never saw, but supposedly was good.
Yeah, supposedly was a vast improvement on the original.
Yes, it was supposedly the preferable Ouija film in the Ouija franchise. And we've heard good things about Gerald's Game. It played at Fantastic Fest. It got good reviews there. Supposedly does a good job adapting a Stephen King book that was supposedly unadaptable.
Yes, one that obviously has its main character pinned, unable to move for like this.
And is mostly sort of a long internal monologue. Mm-hmm. And supposedly the movie does a nice job of figuring a way around that. And supposedly has one scene in particular that is incredibly horrific and gruesome and terrifying. I have no idea what it is, but everyone I talk to... Everyone I talk to about this movie, just all they want to talk about is that there's a scene that freaked them out.
Yes. So...
So that's option one.
Yeah.
If you want to freak us out... this would be a way to do it. Gerald's Game on Netflix.
Option two is streaming on Shudder, which is, as always, a good place to look for all kinds of horror fare. It is Seoul Station. If you were a fan of the Korean Zombies on a Train movie from the other year, Train to Busan, this is a animated prequel to that from the same director, Yeon Sang-ho. He actually worked in animation before he made his live action Train to Busan. So this is not out of character. And this, as the title indicates, takes place in Seoul right around the time when the zombie outbreak that we see unfolding on the train and across the country in Train to Busan is taking place. And like Train to Busan, this movie deals with a lot of kind of class and societal issues by way of showing its outbreak of the undead. In particular, it kind of focuses on these characters who are on the outskirts of society anyway. There's a runaway, there's a homeless man, and it really kind of like is maybe even bleaker in terms of that than Train to Busan, which, you know, you can always get away with when you're working with animation. But if you liked everything that was going on in Train to Busan, this definitely continues those same sensibilities in animated form. So that is your second choice, and that is streaming on Shudder.
Our third option is available on Netflix, and it was almost one of the movies we talked about on this show, because it is another movie involving cannibalism. And normally we would probably not want to do
two cannibalism
movies on two different episodes back to back. But this movie has gotten such a great response, and I know I'm dying to see it. I haven't gotten to see it yet. I'm guessing you have seen it.
I've seen it multiple times, yes.
Multiple times, okay. Well, so this would be a good excuse to see it. We're sort of bending our own rules a little bit to put this on here as our third option. It is Raw. It is, I'll read you only one plot description this time. Forced to eat raw meat during a hazing ritual at her veterinary school, a young vegetarian develops an overpowering hunger for flesh in all of its forms, Allison, you have seen this movie multiple times. What else do we need to know about it?
I would say it would fall under the category, the kind of umbrella of horror, but it is just as much a coming of age story.
Right. Not a classical horror film.
No.
It has horror themes and it's about flesh eating.
But it is in some ways about freshman year of college.
And really, what is more terrifying than that?
It's nightmarish.
I can think of few experiences in my own life that were more nightmarish than the freshman year of college. So I expect to relate to that film on a very deep and personal level. All right. Well, that's option number three, Raw. And that is available on Netflix as well.
Okay. Which of these horrifying movies should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Units? You tell us, send your pick to svu@filmspottingsvu.com or enter in the poll at the bottom of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, October 16th at noon. And after that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, which is @filmspottingsvu. And we'll also put it on Facebook at facebook.com/filmspottingsvu. Please give us a like on there.
Yes.
We've gotten some discussion on there too, which is great.
Yes.
And you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on the next episode, which you can look for around Tuesday, October 24th.
FilmspottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The Filmspotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal, and you can listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.bandcamp.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the horror movie review you pick. But in the meantime, follow us on Twitter @AllisonWilmore and @MattSinger, and follow the show @FilmspottingSVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice, and where we share more streaming suggestions from you and from us, from you to us, and from us to you. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.